I'd like you to turn to Revelation chapter 21. Here we're talking about the New Jerusalem described. It was introduced to us in the first eight verses in regards to the new heavens and the new earth. Here, he spends more time in detail about the New Jerusalem. The first thing that we will see is the New Jerusalem, the bride, the wife of the Lamb. In verse 9, chapter 21, Revelation, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked with me, saying, 'Come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife.' And he carried me away in the Spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God." So here we see the New Jerusalem. Remember, there's a new heavens and new earth. Everything else has passed away. The new heavens and the earth probably existed before the new heavens and the earth were even made. There it tells us that the new heavens and the new earth is something created, whereas the New Jerusalem had previously already existed, had prepared, we see in verse 2, as a bride adorned for her husband. And that verb tense, in the perfect tense, having been prepared. And we gave some evidence of that, such as in John 14, where Jesus said, "I go and prepare a place for you, that where I am you will be also." And it's in his Father's mansion. It's his Father's place. So John opens up here in verse, in the opening address here, and gives a selection by stating that one of the angels who had the seven last plagues, the seven bowl judgments, one of those angels came, and according to Revelation chapter 15, verse 7, and also in chapter 16, those angels are mentioned, that they had the wrath of God. One of them is now approaching John. John is instructed by this angel of what he is seeing, that this New Jerusalem is described as a bride, the Lamb's wife. Now, he's not talking about people. He's talking about the city. And that's important. He showed him the great city, the holy Jerusalem. "I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife." And what is he seeing? The great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. And so the description of a bride or a wife to God is seen in at least three depictions and in different eras, different periods of time. For example, Israel is portrayed as a wife to God in the Old Testament. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea describe that. In Isaiah chapter 54, verse 5, "For your maker is your husband. The Lord of hosts is his name, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. He is called the God of the whole earth." Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 3:14, "Return, O backsliding children." He was referring to Israel in verse 6, verse 8, and verse 11. So the backsliding children is Israel. "And thus says the Lord, I am married to you." A second example that we see of this idea of a bride or a wife is the church that's seen as a bride and a wife to Christ. For example, in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22 to 32, we see this imagery as it relates to how wives and husbands are to respond to each other. And it's likened to how the church responds to Christ. The Apostle Paul states in his zeal for the Corinthian church in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, "I am jealous for you with godly jealousy, for I betroth you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. The church is seen as the wife to the Lamb in the marriage supper of the Lamb in Revelation chapter 19, verse 7. A third example that we have is now the New Jerusalem. This is the eternal state, and it takes on the character of its inhabitants, the redeemed, using the bride-wife imagery. In Revelation chapter 21, verse 2, John sees the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having been prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And of course, in verse 9, I show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. Then in verse 10, as he's being carried away to a mountain where he is shown this great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. So he relates the New Jerusalem as a bride, the Lamb's wife. Secondly, moving from this, in verses 11 to 21, John is shown the splendor and the majesty in describing this new city, Jerusalem. From verse 10, the angel, as he carries away John by the Spirit to this mountain, and from that particular position, there's this vision, the vision of the great city, Holy Jerusalem, and as he sees it coming down from heaven. Now, he's already described that in verse 1 to 8, but now he's giving details about it. The first thing that we see in verse 11 is the mighty or the majestic light of that city. In verse 11, he says that this city, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, her light was like the most precious stone. So you have to imagine the city and the light that's emanating from the city. Her light was like the most precious stone, like a jasper, clear as crystal. And so you have to stop and think about what he's looking at here. What would that jasper resemble? So John sees the brilliance of the glory of God, and his first impression was the radiance like a Cilician jewel. The light could be compared to this precious stone that John probably would have had some familiarity to. And he called it, as the people did in his day, crystal clear jasper stone. So this is different than the gem that we would call jasper. The name for its English today would be a giant blue-white diamond. So think of the light that's emanating from the city is a brilliant blue diamond reflecting light. Having the glory of God. So the city takes on the nature of God's glory. So there's nothing temporary about this. It's beautiful in its manifestation and in the character of that glory. And it radiates from without. Now this brings some other things to mind. For example, in the Old Testament, we see Moses and the people of Israel, when they finished the work of building the tabernacle, that temporary structure, there was a cloud that covered it. And the glory of the Lord filled that particular tabernacle. So as Moses was no longer to even enter it, we have that story, that episode in Exodus chapter 40. When Solomon finished his prayer in the dedication of a physical foundational temple, the first temple, We see in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verses 1 and 2, that fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the house, and the priests could no longer enter into the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord had filled the Lord's house. Now, that glory was still in the temple of the Holy of Holies. When Ezekiel sees in his vision in Jerusalem that temple before it's going to be destroyed, we see that the glory of God begins to, in this vision that he has, he sees the glory of God beginning to leave the Holy of Holies and begins to make its way to the threshold. It continues and goes out the eastern gate and then up to the Mount of Olives, not to be seen again until the millennial time described in chapter 43. Because this temple was going to be destroyed, the one that Solomon built, by Nebuchadnezzar, and the glory of God left it. In another vision, as I already alluded to, Ezekiel was taken to the land of Israel to see this millennial restoration of the land, where Messiah comes. And he's built or restored the earth in Edenic conditions, longevity of life, production of the land, so on. Now the curse has not been lifted, but it's temporarily retarded. There at the eastern gate of Jerusalem, he sees the glory returning back to the temple that the Lord makes and the city that he will be the king over the whole earth. We see this in chapter 43, verses 2 to 5. But the glory that filled that house was still only a partial manifestation compared to the glory that's going to fill this temple or this city, which is permanent and forever. He goes on to tell us about the wall and the gates of the city in verses 12 to 14. In verse 12, he says, "And she had a great and high wall with 12 gates, and 12 angels at the gates, and names written on them," that is, on those gates, "which are the children of Israel. Three gates on the east, three gates on the north, three gates on the south, three gates on the west." 12 gates, 12 tribes with names, one of those tribes on each of those gates. 12 altogether. So the great high wall of the city indicates what? Why would you need? Satan's gone, the evil demons, all wicked people are in the eternal lake of fire. Why do you need a wall? Well, he may be describing God's security for his people forever. May have that idea. But also, I think it has another significant point, that the new city, Jerusalem, has borders. And they are definitely defined, as we're going to see here. The 12 gates indicate that there is an abundance entrance because they're open. They're never shut. Free access in and out of the city into the new heavens and the new earth. The city will be the home and the headquarters of all the redeemed of all history as they have access in and out. Now, they mention that it's got an angel at each of those gates. Kind of reminds us in the ancient culture of watchmen. And I was trying to think about this, and I'm thinking as you're entering or in and coming back in, there's that angel. He may be an encourager. Welcome, beloved of the Lord. I mean, we don't know. It doesn't tell us, but there's an angel at each of those gates. The angel at the gate doesn't seem to be one that's concerned about any danger, because nothing evil or sinful will exist in the new heavens and the new earth. We already saw that in verse 8. Nothing unholy enters this place. Nothing unholy will ever be seen or experienced again for all God's people. And so this is quite significant. In verse 13, the three gates of each side of the wall is a reminder of the way the camp of Israel camped in the wilderness around the tabernacle. And they were assigned three to the north, three to the south, three to the west, and three to the east. So similar type of language that we see in a historical reference of how God has been dealing from the beginning of his people to the end. We see this in Numbers chapter 2. Three tribes from each of those sides. Interestingly enough, we find in Ezekiel's temple in chapter 48 the same description. In the millennial temple, there are 12 gates. Three to the north, three to the south, three to the west, three to the east. And guess what's on each gate? One of the names of the tribe of Israel, equaling 12. Now, let me just make some points here. In Revelation chapter 21, it doesn't tell us the name of the tribes. There's over 20 references to the 12 tribes of Israel in the Bible, all listing 12. All the lists are not the same, because sometimes you have Ephraim and Manasseh there, or sometimes you don't have both those names there. You may have the name Joseph there, and then also you may not have the name Dan there, but you might have the name Levi there. But always 12. So the question is, what list or what names will he have on those gates? So let me give you an idea. So when you think about the last mentioning of the 12 tribes of Israel, what do you see? Well, in chapter 7 of the book of Revelation, what do you have? Well, it mentions this 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel and gives you the names, equaling 144,000. They're going to go out into the world and be witnesses for God, primarily to the Jewish people, but they'll be Jewish evangelists. And it mentions those tribes, but that is not the last mention, because that's in the tribulational era. The last time, the last list you have, come in chapter 48. And you have two lists there. The first list that's described is in verses 1 to 29, and that deals with the division of the land. And in there you have 12 tribes. Dan, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, Reuben, Judah, Benjamin, Simon, Issachar, Zebulun, Gad. But in the last list, which is the last part of chapter 48, it refers to the millennial temple and the gates. That's just in verses 30 to 35. There it mentions on the north, Reuben, Judah, and Levi. On the east is Joseph, Benjamin, and Dan. On the south, you have Simon, Issachar, Zebulun, and on the west, you have Gad, Asher, and Naphtali. Now, what's interesting, in the division of the land, you have Manasseh and Ephraim. They're not even mentioned in the gates. You have Joseph, who's their father. He has a double portion, Manasseh, Ephraim. Well, they're not there. But their father is, right? And you also have somebody else. Because if you got Joseph, wait a minute, you got Manasseh and Ephraim that was in that other list, but you only have Joseph, you got to have somebody else there. Who's that? Levi. Now, what's interesting about this, the very first time that you find the list of the 12 tribes of Israel, which is in Genesis chapter 30, is identical to the last time that you find it chronologically in the Bible. And that's in Revelation chapter 48. The only exception is Benjamin is not mentioned in the one in chapter 30 because he wasn't born yet. He comes a little later and he's added to that list. So from the first and to the last list and all the ones in between, the first and the last are the same. So it's possible, because the connections are so much associated with the temple and distributed between those particular gates, the list that's referring to in the millennial temple most likely is that same list of the 12 tribes in the eternal state. Now, that's my conjecture, because he doesn't tell us exactly the names, but that would make sense. In chapter 4, in verse 14 now, we see the wall with 12 foundations. You keeping track of all the 12s now? Because you already have a few now. You had 12 gates, you got an angel at each one, so you got 12 angels. You're going to have 12 tribes of Israel on each of those gates. And now you have 12 foundations. Verse 14, now the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. 12, 12, 12, 12, 12, 12. Now, the 12 foundations with the names of the 12 apostles ascribed in them show that the New Jerusalem is built upon the foundation of the apostles, and thus the New Jerusalem will be a proper home for the church. The names of the apostles, which are listed on the foundation, is Matthew in that list? Or does Paul take that? I'll leave that up to the Lord. But we know there's only 12. The apostles will already be given the commission to judge and rule over the 12 tribes of Israel during the millennial era, because Jesus mentioned that in promise to them in the regeneration in Matthew chapter 19, verse 28. You will rule over the 12 tribes of Israel in that time, regeneration. Luke refers to the same thing, Luke chapter 22, verse 30. In the New Jerusalem, they will be recognized as foundational apostles for the building of the church, and consequently, their names will be put on the foundation of that city. The church, even now, is built on that foundation of the apostles and the prophets, and become, as it says in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 20 to 22, a holy building or a holy temple for the indwelling of God in His Spirit. Now, this is clear that all true believers of God, of all ages, both from the Old Testament and the New Testament times, are going to be united into one body of people. Clearly, there is no wall between Israel. There's no wall between the church. There will be one city open to all God's people. And this will also include the tribulational saints. That's referred to in chapter 7, verses 9 to 17. You even see them with the Lord. All believers of the millennial era that believed, that were born in that particular area, and all redeemed in Christ. And this is why. Because they are all under the new covenant. And so all saints must necessarily participate in the New Jerusalem city, just as many as they did in the millennial scene, and that happened, without destroying the distinction between the difference of the companies of those saints. Israel, the church, the tribulation saints, the millennial believers. Also, in verses 15 to 17, you see the dimension of the city. Okay, we saw it coming down. We see its brilliance like a blue diamond, crystal clear, radiating from the glory of God. Verse 15, this angel is talking to John. So he says, "He who talked with me had a golden reed to measure the city, its gates, and its walls." Now we got measurements now. So the angel who is talking, it has a golden reed. Now, it's made of gold, but it's as thin as a reed, as a measuring rod to measure the city, its walls, and its gates. So John's watching this, and this is further indicated by that John literally sees a literal city. It's not some kind of a spiritual symbol. It's a reality because it has distinctive dimensions, limits. Everything about the city is absolutely amazing. It's magnificent. This is where your home is going to be if you're a believer. It'd be impossible for any other human architect and builder to produce any such of a city. But the Bible is clear that the builder is not of a human agent. Its designer, its architect, its maker, its craftsman, its creator is God himself. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 10 and in verse 16, it tells us that the heavenly city, which Abraham waited for, has foundations whose builder and maker is God. And he prepared the city and its foundations. Its symmetry, its size, its perfection, its beauty will reflect not only the glory of God, but also his wonderful love for his people as he expresses these things in description here. In verse 16, the city is laid out as a square. Its length is as great as its width. And he measured the city with the reed 12,000 furlongs, or literally stradia. Its length, breadth, and height are equal. This is a cube. Equal in every side, the same. Okay? Now, the size of the city is almost beyond our comprehension. It will have plenty of room for all the believers of all time. 12, here's 12 again. 12,000 furlongs. Now, the Greek furlong, stradia, measures 607 feet, making the size 1,380 miles each side. Okay? This, the height, the width, the length, the depth. The city is four square. It's laid out as a square, literally four-cornered, four angles, and the angles are equal. The length, the width, the height. So I hope you have all this now in your head. You're thinking about all this. The King James, I think, even uses the word four-square. I don't know if churches that came up with the name four-square, if they're thinking about this or not. The word four square is used as squared stones preparing for the building for cubical objects. So this means that the city will be not only a perfect cube, but it's just like the Holy of Holies, where God manifested his presence in the tabernacle, equally squared, and also the structure that Solomon made was a perfect cube, as seen in 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 20. This suggests then that the fact that God has made the city into a cube is the manifestation of the holiness of God. This is the Holy of Holies. And you dwell within the Holy of Holies. God will be with them. You will be with him forever. God's dwelling with men. This is mind-boggling. This is our home. Verse 17. Then he measured its wall 140 cubits according to the measure of a man, that is, of an angle. So the height of the wall is given in terms of the Hebrew cubit instead of the Greek stad. Okay? So the cubit was about 18 inches here. And so 144 cubits of 18 inches will be about 216 feet or 65 meters. Now, some think that the wall of the city would have to be as high as the city, which would be about 1,500 miles. And therefore, they suggest what he's describing here is not the height, but the width of the city. And that makes more sense. The measure of a man means that though the wall was measured by the angel used human measuring standards that John could understand. Now, there's something worth noting here. The number of 12, as I already mentioned, is very prominent, right? We've already seen that. You got 12 gates, 12 angels, 12 tribes of Israel, 12 foundations, 12 apostles, 12, we haven't got there yet, but in verse 21, 12 pearls, those are the gates. The gates are pearls, 12 of them. And then, in chapter 22, verse 2, there's 12 kinds of fruit that are there within the city. The height, the length, the width of the city is described as 1,200 furlongs in verse 16. The wall's height is said to be measured by 12 by 12 cubits. That's 144 cubits or 216 feet there in verse 17. So he uses, again, 12 by telling us about the 144 cubits. 12 by 12 is the idea here. So John sees a city within the walls, and they are pure gold. So the walls are pure gold. They're so clear, it's like glass, looking right through it. In fact, the Greek is it more specific. It means clear glass. Not just any glass, clear glass. So it seems to be a description of something that the new heavens and the earth is better than the gold here on the earth. The gold known in this present earth, it can beat it down under tremendous heat to only a few molecules thick, and then put it on a window, and what do you have? You have a golden leaf. It will not be transparent. Not like glass. So John is using human language to describe something brand new, as best as he can describe it. In its clarity and its transparency, it will reflect God's glory and God's marvelous way emanating from this. In verse 19, the foundations of the wall of the city are adorned with all kinds of precious stones. First foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysophas, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethysts. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each individual gate was one pearl. Think how big that pearl is. Massive. And there's an angel there. And each of those gates got a name of a tribe of Israel. And the streets of the city are pure gold, like transparent glass. Not only are the walls of the city transparent gold, but the seat, and the idea, it's a singular usage, meaning the entire streets are transparent gold. And they got the glory of God ruminating on all those particular gems and all the light bursting forth from all that. Incomprehensible. Now, that means my eyes are going to have to be different to take all that in without any harm. With all that light. We're going to see more about that light 2 weeks from now as we move on from verse 11 in that next section. But as we wrap this up, the 12 foundations of the wall inscribed in the names of the 12 apostles are garnished or adorned or decorated with all kinds of various precious stones, right? The foundation of the glorious, beautiful, are visible to the eye to see. And the jewelry, the ornaments, display the majesty of God. The jasper, again, is used, same word that's used previously, of a blue-white diamond. That's the first foundation. And before I forget, the idea that the fact that they have foundations may suggest that it's going to land on the new earth. Because why would you have foundations in something in space is the idea. So the idea that it has foundations, because you can have a city there suspended, but the fact that it has foundations, probably then it will come to the earth. That's, it doesn't tell us that, but that's a possibility. Sapphire. This is not the modern sapphire, but it's the ancient lapis lazuli. It's a deep blue stone sprinkled with brilliant bits of iron pyrite, fool's gold. So that particular blue stone sprinkled with glittering goldish color. This was prized by the Assyrians and the Egyptians. Then you have the third foundation is chalcedony. That general term was a group of precious stones, including carnelian, sardex, chrysoprase, agate, onyx. Some see this to be a green copper silicate that is found in Chalcedon on the papyrus from modern city Istanbul. The fourth one is an emerald. That was a bright, light, green, transparent, precious stone. A variety of beryls, colored chromium instead of iron, found in Egypt, Cyrus, Ethiopia. In verse 20, he continues by mentioning the fifth foundation, sardonyx. This is a variety of agate, layered stone, red sard, white onyx. It's a hard stone. It's a precious gem, often in agate or onyx, hard-covered. They use these to inject in portraits that they carved. The sixth is sardex, which is a reddish blood stone. Chrysolite, seventh foundation, that's a yellow topaz. Eighth is beryl, that's a sea green color. Topaz, the ninth, that's a golden, greenish gold. Chrysoprase, the tenth foundation. Translucent, apple green. The 11th, jacinth, that's a bluish, purplish, bluish purple color. And the last one is amethyst. That's a clear purple or a blue violet. All shining because of the glory of God. Then he ends this. The 12 gates, the 12 tribes, and the pearls. The pearl in the ancient time was something owned only by the wealthy. God has lavished the city beyond our comprehension. You know, in Solomon's time, they thought silver was nothing. It was just like the stones of the ground. Because he had so much gold invested in his work in the temple that they stopped counting it. When the enemies came in, Babylon came in, when they came in, they began to strip and take what they wanted. Articles of furniture, and finally, when it was finally destroyed, everything was gone. All the gold was stripped. But here, this is eternal, and it's nothing compared to this earth. The pearl of the ancient time might be symbolic for us as we consider Jesus' statement about the kingdom of heaven. In that parable in Matthew chapter 13, as he talked about the kingdom of heaven, he spoke about one goes for it like a pearl of great price. Do you value your life with God more valuable than anything else in this world and the home that God has prepared for you? Or is so much of this life in the occupancy of time, labor, of things that are perishing, things that are people always going after? Jesus said, as the Gentiles, referring to what believers go after. Don't worry about those things. You'll have what you need. But are you so wrestling with the life's concerns of things that God has a very small part in your life? Remember what Paul said? Think on where Jesus is, where heaven is. Think about that. Here's a description of heaven, the reality of it, where the presence of God is there, which he's going to mention in the next section, which we'll talk about next week, the Father and Jesus, how they're there, their light. They are the temple in the midst of the city. And we are there in the midst of that temple, in the Holy of Holies with God. Father, we thank you for this splendor. We thank you for this wonder. Father, all the world is passing away and all its splendor. And yet, if we could combine of all human history, of all the glorious things, it can't come close. Father, help us to pursue which has eternal value. Even treasures in heaven, or if moth does not destroy or rust destroy, moth can't eat it, thieves can't come in and take it away. You preserve this place for us because you love us, you rescued us, you own us. And the greatest heritage for us is having God as our God. And so, Lord, help us to pursue what is most important, the things of God, that has eternal value, and that you would receive the glory in it. In Jesus' name, amen.